I'm not convinced that this administration has gotten the balance right. I think it's going to lead to a lot of confusion, probably more discrimination, perhaps in both directions. And it's going to be really, really difficult for folks to understand their rights.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check. And that was Katie Keith, a Georgetown law professor, health affairs blogger, and this week's guest. Katie's been tracking the many legal battles and regulations involved with the Affordable Care Act, and she's focused especially on protections for LGBTQ patients. I wanted to pick her brain, given the looming hearing over the Affordable Care Act's constitutionality and a number of regulations that the Trump administration recently advanced. Katie was also handpicked by Health Affairs to be the successor to Tim Jost, the prolific blogger, and you'll hear us talk a bit about that gig, too. Katie Keith, welcome to Politico Pulse Check.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you for having me.
You're a lawyer with a healthcare background. Many listeners may know you from your blogging at Health Affairs, where you break down legal challenges, regulations related to the ACA. And that's where I wanted to start. A Texas judge struck down the ACA. The appeals court hearing is coming up in a month at the Fifth Circuit. Is Obamacare in legal jeopardy, really?
Great question. So I think the first point to make there is that the judge did not exactly strike the law down. He declared that it was invalid, which matters for folks because the Affordable Care Act is still sort of fully in effect. People should be paying their premiums and have their coverage and protected, and nothing has changed. So I think that's very, very important. As we look at what the Fifth Circuit does next, you just mentioned the oral arguments will be held July 9th. We will see what the court does there. I think conventional wisdom is that the Fifth Circuit's going to have a few issues with what Judge Reed O'Connor in the Northern District of Texas did in his decision.
Because Judge O'Connor staked out such unusual legal territory unusual in making his ruling.
Is one word for it. That's right.
What would your word be?
No, I mean, I think that's right. It's sort of been panned by legal scholars across ideologies. So conservative legal scholars, liberal legal scholars, the Wall Street Journal, the National Review, everyone has sort of come out and talked about how sort of extreme his decision was in terms of taking the zeroing out of the individual mandate penalty by Congress in the tax reform bill at the end of 2017 and using that as the reason or, you know, really concluding that that meant the entire ACA is now invalid. The idea that that one change would strike down the entire law is quite extreme.
So I want to underline this point because the Fifth Circuit, it leans conservative. It has been populated primarily by conservative judges, or at least judges appointed by Republican presidents. President Obama got, I think, 3 judges over 8 years onto that court. President Trump already has 5 in 2 years. Does that mean anything for when this decision comes before them in terms of the likelihood that Republican-appointed judges will be ruling on a challenge to the ACA?
I'm not sure yet. And I haven't actually looked at the panel that, you know, there'll be 3 judges from that group of judges on the Fifth Circuit that you just highlighted.
And we don't know which ones.
I don't know off the top of my head. And so that will be something, I think, to watch. But the legal argument should carry the day, right? That's what we, as a lawyer, as someone who believes in the rule of law, we all think that, you know, some of the conclusions that Judge O'Connor reached are quite wrong. And, you know, that is sort of the consensus among most legal scholars out there.
My experience reporting on the ACA over the past 10 years has been legal challenges come up that get dismissed, and yet they march forward anyway. I remember when Tim Jost, your predecessor at Health Affairs, was saying that NFIB versus Sebelius, the decision that made it all the way to the court and led to the Medicaid expansion being changed, that was not a serious challenge. And yet it came so close to declaring big parts of the law unconstitutional. And again, here we are with another legal challenge. So are there incentives in the legal academy that might not be reflected in what's actually happening in the courts? The good spirit and the good faith that lawyers like yourself have versus what is actually marching forward in the legal system?
That might be too big and broad for me to answer at this point. I mean, your point is right, though, that in conventional wisdom, I think some folks think the Fifth Circuit will overturn Judge O'Connor's decision and send it back down to his court, and then it will sort of go away. I'm a little bit more, I think, bullish on this, that I'm fully expecting this to go up to the Supreme Court. It only takes 4 justices to grant review of the case, which means it could be there. Depending on when the Fifth Circuit issues its decision, we could be getting this case on the next docket, which in theory could mean a June 2020. Another blockbuster ACA Supreme Court decision in an election year.
And when you say four justices, you're talking about four
Supreme Court justices. To grant review of a case to hear it on appeal. They could certainly say no. There's nothing that requires the Supreme Court to hear cases, but in a world in which it just takes four, you could sort of think about the makeup of the court, and maybe this is a case they want to hear.
Judge O'Connor has issued a number of controversial rulings related to Obama regulations, the ACA. Some of those have moved up the legal system to appeal. Does that give us any indication of what might happen with this ruling on the Affordable Care Act?
I don't think so, no. It's a good question. I do find myself spending a lot of time reading about Judge O'Connor's decisions, though, and I think he is certainly the judge who sort of made this decision declaring the entire ACA to be invalid. That's probably how most of your listeners know him. I'm tracking at least three other cases in his court right now. So things on Section 1557, which he struck down certain provisions from a regulation under the Obama administration.
Section 1557 being the anti-discrimination in healthcare regulation,
that's right,
which we are going to talk about. That's very
right.
important.
So that case is before Judge O'Connor. He has a case on the health insurance tax for Medicaid managed care companies, which is too complex, but it's another ACA challenge where he's invalidated an Obama-era regulation. And then he's actually hearing a class action from individuals challenging the Obama birth control regulations. And so I end up reading a lot about Judge O'Connor, who it's quite unusual, I think, to have even four cases in front of a court on one law, and especially sort of state or class action challenges to federal changes.
Well,
so I would just leave that with you.
Let's not leave it, because it's unusual but deliberate. Reed O'Connor, this district court judge in Texas on the border of the state, has become an influential figure in law because Republican attorneys general are essentially shopping for him. They have figured out a system where they can get these challenges to Obama regulations in front of O'Connor and seem to have a pretty good indication of how he's going to rule. Here at Politico, we have a list of the 50 most important people in politics. I kind of think Judge O'Connor should be on that, given the scope of the impact of his decisions. We've got this ACA ruling, which, to your terminology, the law wasn't struck down. He declared it unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. The ruling that you mentioned on ACA and sex discrimination. Mm-hmm. He's also issued rulings related to transgender protections advanced
for students,
by the Obama administration.
Right.
So clearly an important figure. Is there an equivalent for Democrats? Are they shopping when they're challenging the Trump administration? Are they finding an O'Connor on the left?
So there's people like to say everybody forum shops, and that's certainly true, where you're sort of trying to pick a district. A lot of folks say, oh, well, we'll go in California, we'll file a lawsuit in California. It's likely to go up to the Ninth Circuit, which is one of the more progressive appellate courts in the country. So to a degree, yes, both sides, if you will, sort of forum shop. I think with Judge O'Connor, you're almost judge shopping. And that is in part because he, for a long time, was the only judge in Wichita Falls in the Northern District of Texas. And so there's a reason there's only one judge there. This is about 3.5-4 hours away from where I grew up in Amarillo, Texas. So I've been to Wichita Falls. There should not be more than one, you know, judge. It's a small city. But that meant that a lot of the cases before him, when Texas, and particularly doing multi-state attorney general work, they would file there and they knew they were going to get Judge Reed O'Connor. He's now sort of doing more work in the Fort Worth Division of the Northern District of Texas, where I think he's one of three judges, but he's the only active judge, which still makes it very likely that when you file in one of these divisions, you're very likely to get Judge O'Connor. And so there's some good. The Texas Tribune has a bunch of looked into this further. I think half of all of the challenges to federal changes brought by the Texas Attorney General Office have landed in front of Judge Reed O'Connor.
Half of all
challenges. Half, about half. And in 2015 and 2016, towards the end, as we're sort of wrapping down the Obama administration, all five of Texas-led challenges to federal changes and regulations were heard by Judge Reed O'Connor.
Yes, so a deliberate strategy. I do wonder, California has emerged as perhaps the biggest thorn in the side of the Trump administration. Attorney General there has filed over 50 lawsuits, and California, playing its odds, has a fair number of judges in its courts. Let's go back to the ACA legal challenges. So we have Texas versus the United States coming up on appeal. I mentioned NFIB versus Sebelius. There was also King v. Burwell a number of years ago, which turned on the law's subsidies. Are there any other existential threats working their way through the legal system?
Existential, I would say no, but we are certainly seeing tons of litigation around the Affordable Care Act. I think we're... So no, to the law itself, no. To some of the Trump-era priorities in healthcare, that is where we're now starting to see a number of challenges. So things like Medicaid work requirements, association health plan rules, the Title IX or Title X changes, rather, and on and on. And so sort of cropping up around all the changes that the Trump administration is making, you're sort of getting the reverse effect that you had under the Obama administration, where all of that is being, we're doing health policy by litigation these days. It's all in the courts. Nothing is ever final because it's likely to get challenged. And that is sort of where we are these days.
Let's unpack that a little bit more, Katie, because mm-hmm. those are big changes that the Trump administration has wanted to make. Medicaid work requirements blocked in court, the Title X family planning program, several courts have put that on hold, the changes that the administration wants to make. Teen pregnancy prevention funding cuts rolled back, the association health plan moves, and so on. When you say health policy by litigation and using the courts, is this a conscious strategy by the administration where they're just going to play the odds and push the boundaries and hope that enough courts side with them? Or is this truly just where we are in a litigious environment and polarized politics?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think the Trump administration has been quite bold, let's call it, in their approach. And I think sometimes that boldness has been on the sort of policymaking substantive side where they're going to go big. The association health plan rule, I think, is a good example of that. Congress had been trying to do that and considering proposals like what the Trump administration did by rule for many years and had not been able to do it. So the idea that the executive could come in and do something that Congress hadn't done was a bold idea. And I think that factored into the court's decision and striking that down. They're also being bold on the process. And I think over and over again, cutting quite a few corners, which is why a lot of these rules are sort of being put on hold, at least temporarily. Even on process, the Medicaid work requirements couldn't get by the judge. They had to go back to the drawing board on process. Then by the time they got to the substantive issues, it was also struck down again.
Is this sort of Al Capone getting caught on tax evasion and not the other crimes? I mean, the Trump administration crime here, or at least what the courts are finding, are these things like not giving enough opportunity for comment. Not that the work requirements themselves are necessarily wrong.
Well, on work requirements, they have come back and substantively said, no, this is not consistent with the Medicaid Act, for instance. So
that was the second ruling from
the judge.
That's
right. Yeah. So you sort of get it hit on process the first round and then on substance in the second round. And there, I think in March, the Washington Post did analysis. The Trump administration is sort of, I think their loss rate under challenges under the Administrative Procedure Act, so these procedural and substantive questions and rules they're supposed to follow when they change things, they have lost in court 94% of the time. They've got about a 6% win rate. Most administrations, that loss rate's about 30%. So they're losing a lot more. And that's not just healthcare. That's kind of across the board. I think it has to do with a lot of environmental regulations that they're changing and rolling back and not following procedure. But data like that sort of suggests this is, they're going further. They're being bolder than normal, both on process and substance.
Well, let's park on this for a second, because the APA, the Administrative mm-hmm. Procedures Act, this is wonky, but yet it seems like the kind of challenge that perhaps the Trump administration is going to overcome over time. So we talked about Medicaid work requirements, first put on hold because the procedures weren't followed. So the Trump administration did more around procedures, and then the judge, who was an Obama appointee, put the program on hold anyway. But the longer President Trump is in office, and if he's reelected, there will be even more of this. There are more judges appointed by this administration, which would increase the odds that there are going to be favorable minds hearing these challenges. Or do I have that wrong?
I think that's certainly a concern. I will say there have been other challenges. You know, the association health plan rule was struck down by a George W. Bush appointee. The rule doesn't hold kind of across the board. I think a lot of judges are taking these things very seriously and going, there are limits to what you can do under federal law, whether it's the Medicaid Act or ERISA or whatever the change might be.
I want to go deeper on what the Trump administration is doing around religious rights in healthcare and its rollback of LGBTQ protections. That's something you've thought a lot about, we've talked about for Politico coverage. Last month, the administration announced a series of changes. Chiefly, the Trump administration finalized its rule to strengthen religious protections for workers who might have objections to delivering care. And second, they proposed a new rule to replace Obamacare's anti-discrimination policy. That was Section 1557. But it effectively rolled back LGBTQ protections across a number of different HHS regs. Readers can see more about this in the show notes. I've talked to folks in the administration who have said they had to make these changes, specifically the changes to the Obamacare Section 1557, because it was required by the courts. Yes or no, is that true?
Poof. Yes and no, is what I would say. So yes, Judge Reed O'Connor sort of struck down the Obama-era rules to include transgender people and termination of pregnancy, meaning someone who's had maybe a medical history of abortion in the past. In that instance, I think in the HHS, the Department of Justice, sort of agreed with the court and said, yes, send us back this rule, we'll fix it. What they could have done. So in that respect, yes. Was this required by the court? No. DOJ could have appealed this decision. They could have fought it. They could have made different decisions.
So it's selective hearing by the Trump administration on what they wanted to do.
It was certainly within, you know, the realm of possibilities that they could have taken a different strategy here and actually defended the regulation that was put in place in 2016. Instead, they let it sit for, I think, more than 2 years and then announced this proposed rule recently and made a series of other changes. They actually went much, you mentioned this, they went much further than sort of this narrow ruling that Judge O'Connor had, which is he would have said that sex discrimination does not include gender identity and termination of pregnancy. And in fact, what the Office for Civil Rights is proposing instead is to erase all kinds of references to sexual orientation, to sex stereotyping, to gender identity, to termination of pregnancy, and on and on and on. So it, yes and no is really the best answer there.
Dropping the legalese, what does this mean for patients in terms of actual impact?
So nothing yet. It's a proposed rule. Nothing is changing. The 2016 regulation that the Obama administration put in place is still there. What I'm concerned about, though, is the degree of confusion that this creates for patients and providers. You know, do you see insurance companies or hospitals or clinics start to roll back protections that they might have extended or, you know, make decisions about discriminatory treatment or not based on the, you know, in reliance on the proposal, that kind of thing. I also worry that it's going to discourage people, you know, vulnerable communities already, like transgender people, from not getting the healthcare they need because they are nervous or anxious or scared for their lives.
I hear that. And that's something that LGBTQ groups have told me. But do we have any evidence that under the Trump administration, these various rollbacks of protections are leading to more discrimination, more denials of care? Do we know that yet?
I don't think we know that yet. I think there's going to be a series of studies coming up. The National Center for Transgender Equality is redoing its big survey next year, I believe. I think we're going to start to see that data. I will say that every time there is some big rollback or announcement around LGBTQ rights, anecdotally, I've heard that, you know, you see more calls to suicide hotlines and things like that. There, you know, whether we have the studies and the data just yet, I think I do worry about what people think and feel when they see these headlines, and folks do, I think, feel under attack.
Let's make sure we're looking at it from the other perspective. The Obama administration advanced protections for LGBTQ individuals, the bathrooms and the military and healthcare became an election issue. Some Americans upset about this. Some religious workers arguing that they felt like their beliefs were being violated because they were being encouraged to participate in procedures against their will. Katie, do we have any evidence of religious workers facing discrimination?
So, Dan, I know you've written about this. I think what the Office for Civil Rights pointed to, at least in its rationale for putting out its rule, is sort of an uptick in complaints from religious workers. There's a balance to be done there. I'm not convinced that this administration has gotten the balance right. I think it's going to lead to a lot of confusion. It's going to lead to probably more discrimination, perhaps in both directions. And it's going to be really, really difficult for folks to understand their rights. Examples in the rule, in the conscience rule, for instance, where the Office for Civil Rights sort of didn't give a clear answer is, you know, what if a woman is, can an ambulance worker refuse to take a woman having an ectopic pregnancy to the hospital? Treatment for ectopic pregnancy can be an abortion. And that was a question they sort of didn't answer or didn't speak to. Can someone who is bleeding out or having some kind of complication from an IUD, can they be turned away without the person having to make a referral of where you get treatment? And so these are sort of questions they left open. So, you know, is there evidence of other discrimination? I think the Office for Civil Rights would say yes. Are there some real questions that where lives hang in the balance that I don't know that we know the answer to and that keep me up at night sometimes? I think that's also true.
The real test case will be if someone is in dire straits, gets turned away by a worker citing religious objection, and maybe that worker is in the wrong. Maybe the Civil Rights Office will say, no, you were wrong to turn this patient away, but yet it's been 3 weeks and the episode has passed and some harm was done to the patient in the interim. I will say there has been an uptick in complaints, as you mentioned, the Civil Rights Office has pointed to that. We don't know how real some of those complaints are. And what I mean by that is not all of those complaints have warranted a full investigation. In fact, only a handful have been investigated and closed. So while there's more coming into the office, how much of that is wheat and how much is chaff remains to be seen. The office did cite, and we talked about this for a story, some very old data by Kellyanne Conway and her polling firm 10 years ago that surveyed a cherry-picked group of religious workers who said they had objections, but those workers are not the majority of physicians as far as we can tell. Taking a step back from these regulations, what do you see, Katie, as the administration's legal strategy around healthcare and LGBTQ rights?
Well, they have, I think, not only reversed many of the sort of Obama-era positions, they're really backtracking in addition to sort of rolling back these regulations, they are taking positions in court that are completely opposite of where, for instance, the EEOC has been, where the prior Department of Justice
Equal
has been.
Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
That's right. And so you've, a lot of this is sort of going to the Supreme Court now, so folks might not be aware that, but there's going to be three LGBT cases heard under Title VII, which is federal civil rights employment law. And the question there is, does sex discrimination include a sexual orientation and gender identity? So are LGBT people already protected under federal employment rights law? And that is a question that we're likely to hear from the court in June of 2020. The Trump administration is weighing in on those cases and saying, no, we don't think so. Whereas the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has sort of taken a different position for many years now. And so you've kind of got the government in some cases on both sides of some of these legal issues based on prior positions that have been taken.
There can be a lot of yo-yoing in the next few years. That's with right. The Trump administration pushing its policies, the potential of a Democratic administration coming in, quickly reversing that, the Supreme Court weighing in, shaking up regulations too.
So when I think about the provider conscience rule that was just finalized and will go into effect at the end of July, assuming it is not challenged because there have been many legal challenges
to it
already.
It has been challenged, assuming there's no
that's
injunction.
Right. That's yeah. right. The way I sort of view that rule is because some of these questions that I'm sort of raising or that you've raised in your work, Dan, is, you know, what does the Office for Civil Rights do next? Now that they've sort of given, they have this authority, they can run with these changes, they can go after states or hospitals that violate provider conscience protections, what do they do? And how aggressive are they going to be? And so kind of watching them set up a religious freedom and conscience division, asking for more funding to sort of support that work, and then having advisors like Matt Bowman, who's moved from the general counsel's office, and as a former attorney at the Alliance Defending Freedom.
And a former anti-abortion protester.
That's right. All of that suggests to me that perhaps they are going to be ramping up and may very well be quite aggressive in enforcing some of these changes. I think that's why you've seen legal challenges from cities and counties and attorneys general and all kinds of different providers already.
Yeah. To put that in plain English, the Office of Civil Rights, which historically had been a protector under the Obama administration of LGBTQ individuals, has now become a center for advancing regulations that LGBTQ patients are extremely worried about. It's been a total flip. Let's close the podcast by talking a bit about you and your career. I got to know you and your work because you took over for Tim Jost, the longtime blogger at Health Affairs, who had a column analyzing the ACA. And at the time, that you took over, Chris Fleming of Health Affairs, described you as having, quote, Jostian attention to detail and Jostian stamina.
Anything, I love the word Jostian. It's high praise in my book.
Well, Tim Jost is worthy of high praise. As a reporter, he did a couple things that made him so valuable to me and my cronies. This is a lesson if you're listening and want to be an expert who gets quoted by reporters. I think first, he was prolific in that he had written something on virtually every corner of the ACA. So if I'm Googling for section 1029, there's the Tim Jost column analyzing it. And then he might also be the only person writing about that, which made him de facto expert. But even beyond kind of that land grab, he was really quick and really pithy when a reporter reached out with questions. It feels like you've inherited that mantle as the column author. How do you decide where you're going to focus your health affairs work?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's everything you said about Tim and more. I am writing even less than Tim, if you can believe it. But I think it's trying to focus on the thing. It is the things that folks aren't writing about. And I think the goal from Health Affairs, from Chris Fleming, from Tim, part of passing that torch is to continue that sort of unbiased, very quick, but thorough analysis of all the different changes, whether it's illegal decisions or new regulation or new guidance, and sort of tracking everything that's going on. And I think it's also very much to Health Affairs' credit to sort of see this as a service to folks and to continue providing that type of analysis. And it's an incredible amount of work for them, too. They're often up just as late as I am editing and help. You know how it is to have a whole team, and it takes a lot to get this stuff out there. And so they've had that vision, too, of understanding that this is important for folks.
Just one last question. Do folks recognize you differently at healthcare conferences now that you're the health affairs blogger?
Sometimes having my face on the blog.
It's really big.
A little
yeah,
bit interesting.
Yeah, the giant picture.
Yeah.
Just kidding. It's a little photo in the corner.
It's been an incredible honor to sort of step into Tim's shoes and try to fill them in a way that no one will ever fill. But it has been sort of a joy to try to continue to do the work that he did and to hopefully make him proud.
He was one of a kind, continues to be one of a kind, mm-hmm. And we're grateful for your analysis on Pulse Check today. Katie, thank you for sitting down.
Thank you so much, Dan.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Katie Keith for making time for the conversation and Jenny Ament for producing the show. If you like Pulse Check, you can help us. Find it on your favorite podcast app, rate or leave a review. That helps new listeners discover the show. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com by email, and you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week. Thanks for listening.